Yeah, Ted. Good morning. So, between my own procrastination and the end of the world as we knew it following the Cubs win, I haven't gotten as much sleep this past week as would be good, so if I nod off, wake me up. I'm tempted to begin this way. When I stop to look at it, I mean really carefully look at it, I see how absurd this picture is. I mean, it's me, a white American citizen, 40-something-year-old man, in the prime of his life, in the early 21st century, getting ready to sermonize about the rich man and Lazarus. Right? I mean, we all see this. My narrow little demographic is, despite what this week's election may yield, probably the wealthiest, most powerful cultural type in the history of the world. This is who my face and my intellectual heritage represent. This is who I am, and I am supposed to preach about the rich man and Lazarus. It's a step or two beyond ironic. It's almost like there's some hubris going on here, especially since it's not like I just stumbled out of bed, half awake, up to this microphone, and someone from the worship committee shoved the parable in front of my face and said, "Try this on for size." No, it's like hubris because Carmen Horst called me up a month and a half ago and said, "What do you think? Would you be willing to at least consider this?" And after about a day, I called her back and very gamely and in full control of my own faculties said, "Sure, I can do that." Ha, ha, ha. How's that for a disclaimer? The kingdom's about to get turned upside down, and the joke will be on me. And yet, there is some comfort that I can take because Jesus himself hung out with tax collectors and other men and women of means and invited them to the kingdom also, along with all the others whom he loved, and some even played important roles in his movement. Nicodemus, the woman who anointed him with expensive perfume. And also, I'm not as wealthy or powerful or quite as hubris-primed as that other paragon of 21st century white North American manliness. I thought I might here mention Carl Shelley or Dale Clawson or, or Marshall King or either of the Eric Kurtzes. But none of them quite measure up. So you know who I really mean. So where do I get off trying to say something about this parable? I have to start over. I am not smart enough or good enough or wise enough to offer you anything. I'm not even a trustworthy conduit for the divine to channel something through. I start this way not to denigrate what follows or to cheapen my efforts or your time here this morning, but simply to recognize that the rich man and Lazarus is a tough, tough, unrelenting parable which offers no reprieve and barely any comfort. I am disturbed by it and have found myself awake in the middle of the night, haunted by the real possibility that my own eternity in hell is in hell because of it. I feel stripped down and laid bare and not relieved, but rather deeply and painfully ashamed. What I'm saying is that I identify with the rich man. I don't know how to qualify the rich man's extravagances, though some of the commentary I've read says the details are supposed to suggest extreme opulence. I don't think I live in extreme opulence compared to anyone here, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure there are some in the wider community, though not literally at my gate, who would see my lifestyle as very lush, not to mention Syrian and Afghan and South Sudanese refugees and many others. And certainly I can't care for all of these. I know that. But have I even cared adequately for those nearest to me? This is what the parable is designed to make us contemplate. I don't, however, think it is designed to make us feel bad about our efforts. That is, its intention is not to set us up for failure, a bar so impossibly high that we can't reach it. After all, the rich man's indifference to Lazarus is really beyond the pale. I, at least, give money to alcoholic Kurt down at the park when he needs it, or give a ride and buy bananas for the emotionally disturbed man heading downtown, or listen and listen and listen to down-on-his-luck Rich telling me all he suffered for the 40th time. And yet, I'm quite certain that I haven't bought my way into heaven yet. A few weeks ago, this is actually what I found myself calculating. I haven't yet given enough to get into heaven. I felt that this parable, this rich man, was drowning me. On my bike, I came to the overpass. I intended to go across on the east sidewalk, but there in the median, as some of us have seen lately, was a woman panhandling with a cardboard sign in her hands. Three kids, out of work. I crossed to the median. I knew I had money in my pocket. I was almost giddy as I pulled it out and handed it to her. She seemed startled and then said, "God bless you." And I received that blessing like, I don't know, it was like I was going to my Aunt Sue's cabin when I was little. In other words, going to heaven. So I hugged her. Then I rode away, and by the time I was across the overpass, I recognized that what I'd given wasn't so much to fill her need, but rather to assuage my own. Tuesday was All Saints' Day. It's so designated because there are so many saints and so many unsainted though revered people, both officially in some canon and also not officially, that the calendar can't begin to recognize and feast them all. So there's a day set aside to celebrate them. Not as a catch-all, but as a moment to be in awe of so much holiness. Most of them are dead, though the theology says that their souls are very much alive and available to us. Día de los Muertos, Day of the Dead, the little I've read about it, seems to combine ancient Aztec beliefs in Mexico with Catholic doctrine, and focuses very squarely on loved ones who have died. There are all-night picnics at grave sites with candles and live music, elaborate decorations and sugar candy skulls. Part of the belief is that at this moment of the year, about halfway between fall equinox and winter solstice, the space between the living and dead is narrowed so that the spirits can move into our realm to visit and comfort us. A place may be set at the table for the visitors. Some church history suggests that similar beliefs about the veil between living and dead were a feature of early All Saints tradition. For myself, and I must imagine for most of us, I sense my own mortality pressing closer and surer with every passing year. I've usually felt comforted by the small constellation of saints that attend me, or circle me, or wait for me, a best friend, children, grandchildren, are those whom I long for most keenly. They are the ones who have already gone ahead of me, past life and death, and I train my hope on the truth of their super reality. But of course, I would be lying if I said I didn't fear my own death, the last bed to lay in, the last morning to wake to, the last words to hear. Even though there are moments when I think, what a blessed comfort. And maybe more than my own death, I fear all the other deaths which I will have to absorb, each one a further diminishment of my own life. I wish I had something funny to say right here. Well, I do pretty much as all the rest of us do, I think, faced with the certainty of death, while paying lip service from time to time like this, I try like hell to stave it off, for me and for my loved ones. So how do we do this? Wealth. In short, we pile up as much stuff as we can to maintain our bodily functions as long as we can, and also to distract ourselves from the inevitable thing which we want to avoid. I'm not saying anything new to anybody here. I know that. I'm just trying to help pull the thread through from All Saints' Day to the rich man and Lazarus. So wealth is a powerful narcotic. It is extremely effective, an extremely effective way to prolong life and to numb ourselves to the inconvenient darknesses of life, many of the petty ones, but also the large ones, and certainly even the largest inconvenience of all. And wealth isn't only measured by dollars and numbers. Wealth comes in the form of grievances and responsibilities and guilt and addiction and busyness. The more of any of these things that we surround ourselves with, the less we have to deal with the fissures in our bedrock. Busyness is one of the things I am most fond of socking away. It keeps me nicely distracted. The rich man is also distracted. I would say that he is profoundly distracted. The parable implies that he enjoys his distraction. It sounds like decadence all the time. He's so distracted by his wealth that there's no mention that he even notices Lazarus, even though Lazarus is at his gate covered with sores, on the threshold where the rich man has to step over him or around him. What I found myself wondering one evening is, my God, what in the world does the rich man need so much distraction from? What overwhelming darkness lurks within him that he must so utterly anesthetize himself to anything which may suggest that fearful thing? What is it that Lazarus represents to the rich man, something so reprehensible, that he essentially ignores the poor man's existence? What is the consuming pain which is so intolerable that a life devoid of empathy is the only one the rich man can lead? So what of my own darkness? The deep, private pain which I bear in solitude. I referenced it earlier, something that feels shameful, something that I don't even fully understand, and in fact am hard-pressed to name, whose origin lays beneath a murky layer of scab and pus. A wound, or maybe a series of wounds, whose roots I fear are so extensive that to diagnose and pull them out would obliterate the person I am. Yeah, I'm talking about a psychic wound, a soul darkness. But we know, don't we, how real and how disruptive this kind of pain is. We grow very adept at masking it, at living through it, at distracting ourselves from it. I know I do. Surrounding myself with the accoutrements of busyness and meaningfulness, say, preparing a sermon. These are manifestations and evidence of wealth. I, in fact, fool myself into not feeling deeply for hours or days or weeks or more at a time. And yet, as sure as I'm admitting it all to you, I know it's a game and a thin one at that. You all, knowing me in various degrees, are able to recognize what is eating me, could tell me about my demons, or at least guess closely at them. The wealth that I amass for protection and dissociation is in truth the most obvious symptom of the things I most fear. I keep busy, amassing more of my peculiar treasure so that I won't have time to explore the caverns inside. My empathic capacity atrophies, and so I am the rich man. I wonder how much this sounds like the standard preoccupations of a man on the brink of midlife and the often associated second-guessing that goes with it. The good news is, I'm not dead yet. Whether or not I'm near midlife, this morning, this moment, I am quite alive. And in the stark terms of this parable, this is a big deal. This counts for a lot, that I'm not dead yet. Being alive, I can take counsel from Moses and the prophets and from Jesus and the saints through Jesus in this parable. Maybe these all should be treated like an unflinching mirror to help me see clearly who and what I am. Amy Jill Levine, in her short stories by Jesus, says that Jesus' original audience, unburdened by 2,000 years of filtering and allegory and interpretation, would have heard the story with a simple literalness. Those who don't do their part in life will be tormented in afterlife. We don't like to hear that. I don't like to hear that. It frightens me. It doesn't sound like the merciful God I want. And yet, it does have the very clear-cut effect, at least for me, of honing in on my dead weight, forcing me to face it, to dig down into those awful roots, to pull myself inside out, to begin transformation, to feel my life with more honesty, and so feel the lives of others around me with more honesty, to attend more compassionately to the souls who surround me, because I recognize the dying and raising to life Christ as present in my pit as well as in yours. This is what is necessary. For me, this is what I take from the parable. Accomplishing it may be akin to pushing a camel through the eye of a needle, but at least I'm aware. And there's another aspect to this. I've given a very introspective, very interior interpretation of the parable. Wealth is the distraction which keeps me from getting in touch with my darkness, which in turn opens a wider and wider gulf of isolation between myself and my God and all creation. This works for me, and I think it may work for some others too. But there is also the sweet relief of practicing real generosity. And I want to emphasize practicing. While the soul searching is essential, so is the do it by faith practice of giving pieces of myself away in money form or time or foolishness. This outward practice can serve as model for inward work, and it lays the velvet living skin of the kingdom over the raw bones of our suffering sisters and brothers. I cannot buy my way into heaven, but I believe that I can give myself away into the great nerve center, the perfecter of all feeling, the one who holds all and makes all whole, the healing heart. As evidence, and to close, this is what happened to me on All Saints' Day. In the morning, while I walked my little terrier-poodle mix in the dark, I asked those saints who are dearest to me to come close and speak to me. I tried to listen for them through the day. It was a very busy day. The moments I remember to listen were brief and agitated. At the Goshen College Music Center for Anya's piano lesson in the late afternoon, we peeked quietly into the performance hall to steal a few moments of the rehearsal for the Requiem for Peace. My children and I crouched together listening. Natasha was at work. I think we all could have stayed longer. Maybe we should have. I thought I heard something which I recognized. As I was getting supper ready later, it occurred to me that maybe what I heard was Gorecki's Symphony of Sorrow. Who knows this piece? Anybody? Gorecki? Okay. Closer to 20 years ago, I was in Canada. I was at the Six Nations Reserve, Iroquois Reserve, doing native gardening, an MCC summer term, and I was paired with a guy from Saskatchewan, younger than me, even back then, and he introduced me to this piece by Henryk Gorecki, which was written in the 1950s, I believe, as a response to the Holocaust, and it's a devastating piece. So as I was getting supper ready, it occurred to me that maybe what I heard was Gorecki's Symphony of Sorrow. I thought, might be appropriate for All Saints' Day, for the awful judgment which is passed in this parable, for our election, for any number of heartbreaking tragedies. I dug through my stacks of old CDs and found it, years since I'd listened to it. I put it on. So beautiful, so aching. It begins barely audible, with lowest register of strings, and slowly grows wave by wave, running higher and higher, cresting, then building again to a new crescendo of helplessness, up and up, louder and louder. And just before it breaks, and the solo female voice enters, Leaf, banished by his sister from the piano room, walked in with his drum, sat down, and began to pound. The door to the piano room now open. I could hear the piano also. And as if on cue, Teo came down, wondering what this music was, promptly stretched himself out on the couch about 5 feet from Leaf, and started playing his penny whistle. He's quite good. My children, each one of them, blithely, unselfconsciously, happily, playing their own thing, piano, drum, penny whistle, in their own world, on top of one of the most expressive, most cathartic, most harrowing pieces of music written in the 20th century. It was a complete, unmitigated, disastrously glorious cacophony. I stood there at the stove. I was stunned. I wasn't even mad. And at that moment, I heard the saints. I heard my saints right in front of and around me. I listened. I don't know how to translate it, but I understood it. I felt it right down to the core. Pretty soon, it descended into shouting and yelling because no one could hear what they were playing. But by then, it was time to eat. I turned down the gareki and let it play out while we finished, and it was all really good. I mean, it felt like the right way to put the day to rest, along with all my fraught and tangled expectations. I knew at that moment that I wasn't going to have time anymore that night to work on this sermon. There was too much to clean up, plus get the kids to bed, but it was all right, because I'd heard something from the saints. And in that relaxed moment of insight, when I stopped adding and subtracting, hoping and wishing and thinking and analyzing, and instead felt the simple breath of give and take, open and close, receive and release, die and live, the real message came. Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson. Turn it on. Give up your busyness, your dishwashing, your need for approval, for adoration, to be seen as wise or important or righteous or cool or creative or desirable or any of the other things you need. Abandon yourself to this night, to these saints. Abandon the precious materials of your carefully crafted aspect. Give it all away and just feel. Feel what happens. Turn it up. Dance. I did. We did. A full-on Michael Jackson freakout. Gave our arms and legs and bodies over to idiot joy. Danced till we were laughing and sweating and I was stinking. And then we kept going, boogalooing like our little terrier poodle when we come home at the end of the day, shaking all over, helpless and happy. It felt so good. The iPad came out and some video was taken. I thought about showing some of it here, because seeing it is so much better than me trying to describe it. But then I thought, it might be even better in your imaginations. So go ahead. Troubling God, none of it is mine. You will take all that I cling to. The very last bit. It is both what I want more dearly than life and what I fear more darkly than death. Come to me in the numb shadows. Prick me with your serpent fang. Warm me with your beetle breath. Pull me down till I am willing to give my guarded, gilded heart away, and so live on with the saints in the tireless rhythm of your spacious heart. Amen.